From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. In just 25 minutes now, President Bush will step up to an East Room podium and face the White House press corps in a rare solo press conference. It will be just the 12th press conference of his presidency, and only his third in prime time. Compare that to Bush's predecessors. By February of his fourth year in office, Jimmy Carter had given 53 press conferences, Ronald Reagan 21, Bill Clinton 40, and George H.W. Bush 72. George W. Bush dislikes press conferences, but the pressure is on tonight for the president to reassert his view of world and national events. There is a lull, but maybe only temporarily, in the bloody fighting in Iraq. The 9/11 hearings continue to probe his administration's early performance. And a Newsweek poll out this weekend put Democratic contender John Kerry 7 points ahead of the president at 50% to Bush's 43% in a mock vote. Tonight on Point, up-to-the-moment political analysis and the president's live primetime press conference from the White House. We begin tonight with the view from President Bush's re-election drive. Earlier, I spoke with Ken Melman, campaign manager for Bush-Cheney 2004. I asked him what tough issues President Bush will be discussing this evening.
Well, I think the president will talk about a number of different issues. Obviously, he'll talk about America's continued efforts to protect our homeland and fight the war on terror, of which Iraq is an important part. I think he'll probably talk about other issues that are important to him, too, like the economy. He's very committed to make sure that every American who's looking for a job can find one. But I think that, obviously, we think the two most important issues on this election and the two most important issues before the country, quite frankly, are how we continue to fight and win the war on terror and how we keep the economic recovery going forward and make it even stronger.
Let me put it to you then again. It's been a tough week or 12 days on the Iraq side. This is unusual for this president to be before the press in active give and take. Where do you think the toughest stuff will come from?
I can't predict what the toughest questions will be. I leave that to you and your colleagues in the media.
This president has not held many press conferences, 12 in his presidency. This is the first in 2004. Why now, Ken Melman?
Well, I think that tonight obviously is a good opportunity to update the American people and talk about our continuing efforts to fight and win the war on terror. There have been a number of challenges in that front, but look, the president and the American people are very committed and they're resolute and understand the stakes here and understand that this war on terror is going to be a long and sometimes difficult battle, but that it's one that we must fight because our homeland security and our freedom is at stake.
The latest Newsweek poll has presumptive Democratic nominee Senator John Kerry leading the president in a two-way trial heat by 7 points, 50% to 43%. What do you make of this? What's your plan to pump up the president's poll numbers?
I think that at the end of the day, when Americans focus on the clear choice they have on November 2nd, I'm confident the president's going to win. But I'm also confident it's going to be a tough-fought election because the country's closely divided. We always said we thought that at key points we'd be behind and at key points we'd be even. Other points will be ahead. Other polls show different things, but again, it's going to come down to a fundamental choice. It's going to say, do you believe that the way you deal with the threat of international terrorism is to proactively go after the terrorists and is to make sure we change laws at home, like the Patriot Act, in order to protect the American people? The president believes you do. John Kerry has adopted a very different pre-9/11 approach, which says the war on terror is not really a war. When it comes to the economy, there's going to be a big question, too. Do we keep the economic recovery going forward, or what would happen to that recovery if John Kerry were to impose his $900 billion in higher taxes in the first 100 days? So these are going to be very big questions, and I think that the polls of a week are much less important than where the American people stand on these important questions.
What do you make of the impact of the last week and a half of 9/11 commission hearings and the last week and a half's rough news out of Iraq for President Bush?
I think that the last week and a half has reminded all Americans and, frankly, people all over the world that we face a series of challenges today. They're in Iraq and there are other places, too, around this threat of international terrorism. And I think that it reminds all of us of the importance of resolute leadership to proactively go after the terrorists. The 9/11 Commission is finding that it would have been better if militarily, way, way back, there had been an attack on the terrorists. Now, We're taking proactive action to anticipate risk so we avoid the next 9/11. And obviously the battle in Iraq shows us that there are still people, whether it's Al-Qaeda or whether it's in Iraq or whether it's others, who obviously despise our country and are looking for ways to continue their efforts and continue terrorist support. We're going to fight them. We're going to defeat them there, because if we do it there, we're safer here. So I think when you step back and think about the last couple of weeks, what you find is the importance of resolute and proactive leadership at home and abroad in dealing with the war on terror.
Ken Millman,
there's something else, though, I think is important, too. And I was a little disappointed in there was an op-ed that Senator Kerry placed in today's Washington Post that seemed to blame this country's efforts in Iraq on the insurgency we face. The insurgents we face in Iraq are not upset because the American people have liberated them from Saddam Hussein. There are insurgents in Iraq who are attacking Americans and are taking hostages because of the fact that they support terrorists, because these are evil people who oppose democracy, who oppose liberty, who don't want to see democracy succeed in Iraq. To say that the American liberators are to blame for these remnants who seek to restore tyranny and disorder and who seek to terrorize innocent people, I think, is a disservice to the men and women who are serving in Iraq and totally misunderstands the challenge we face. We face people who hate democracy, and we face people who support terrorism, and the solution is not to try to say, how do we co-opt them or deal with them? The solution is, how do we bring them to justice?
Ken Millman, let me ask you just on another front quickly. The president has raised a lot of money, $158 million by the latest count. John Kerry is out raising money right now. Do you think you'll have a real challenge from the Democratic contender on the campaign spending front or not?
Well, I do. I actually think we're going to be outspent. Now, we're not going to be outspent by the Kerry campaign, but when you've got is this whole shadowy network of these 527 organizations, for those of your listeners that are not familiar with what I'm talking about, these are organizations that are under 527 as part of the Internal Revenue Service Code, who are out there right now planning to attack the president, running ads against the president, coordinating and providing activities on behalf of the Kerry campaign. They're using soft money, which is banned under the McCain-Feingold law. So you've got one side that's operating under one standard and the other side that's operating under another standard. So I do think it's going to be very competitive financially, and we may very well be outspent.
Final question, Ken. The images out of Iraq in the last dozen days have not been good. How has the president taken the rough news from Iraq recently?
Well, obviously, look, the president and everyone grieves for the soldiers and the sailors and the airmen and Marines and the hostages and the families involved. Anytime an American is lost or is injured or is killed in harm's way, it's terrible, and we grieve for them. But we also need to remember the incredible importance and the nobility of their mission. And we need to remember that these Americans are fighting so that in America, all of us are safer because the terrorists are defeated in Baghdad and the people of Boston are therefore safer.
Ken Millman, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Ken Millman is manager of the Bush-Cheney reelection campaign. He spoke with us earlier today from Washington. Joining me now from New York is John Podhoretz, columnist at the New York Post and author of Bush Country, How W. Became a Great President While Driving Liberals Insane. Good evening and welcome, John Podhoretz.
Thanks for having me again.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Jack, let me go first to you. Just on the timing of the president's press conference tonight, it is an unusual event for this president, and not in a particularly lovely moment. There's some tough stuff going on. Why now?
Well, there's a pause in the fighting. We don't know how tenuous that is, but or whether that will be the beginning of a plateau. But at least for the moment, there's a pause. So he's, bodies aren't falling, or at least in numbers right now. Also, it's just been a very bad patch for him politically. His former counterterrorism chief says that far from being on battle stations before 9/11, the president was more or less asleep at the switch. Now, politically, that isn't really the explosive charge it may seem. Democrats, Democratic interest groups have tested, Bush was to blame ads before focus groups, and people say, we don't want any part of that. The public clearly seems to say both administrations were responsible. But the second part of Clark's charge is the one that is really damaging to the president, potentially, is that, of course, the war in Iraq is greatly undermining the war on terror. That that one really hurts because that is Bush's alone. It isn't Bush and Clinton shared. And in Iraq, you know, we don't, I'd be redundant to say how bad things are going. But, you know, just look at the way the president had hoped things were going. Right now, he was wanted to see troops being withdrawn. Well, of course, they're being recycled. 10,000 soldiers who were handing in their ammunition are now going to have to go through another cycle in Iraq. And some people think that they're even going to be more reinforcements sent from here. And again, that's going to raise questions about the administration's fundamental strategy, because for months, for years, from over a year, people have been telling them you need more troops. Finally, they're doing it. And then, of course, the polls. I mean, the polls, you mentioned the one about Kerry ahead. You know, according to Charlie Cook, no elected incumbent president has gone on to defeat a challenger whom he trailed in the polls after February. Well, we'll see whether that's true this time, but it's on Iraq that the polls have really hurt. Support for Bush's handling has plummeted below 45%. Nearly two-thirds of a recent poll said things were going badly for the U.S. there, and nearly half of Americans now say they doubt that we will be able to establish a successful and stable government there. So a lot of trouble for the president.
John Podhoretz, how do you see it? Is it as stormy a sea as all that that he walks into tonight in the East Room before the press corps?
Oh, it's a stormy sea, all right. I mean, we have American troops. You know, there may be a lull at the moment, but American troops are engaged in combat. You know, there have been more casualties, you know, in a week now than since the actual fighting of the war. And it is, I was thinking about this, that there is an amount of news, simply just like an onrush, a cascade of news, unlike anything we've seen really since the weeks after September 11th. We not only have Iraq and the 9/11 Commission, we have economic data coming out every day that is actually favorable to the president. We have, you know, books. We have Bob Woodward's book is coming out. We had Karen Hughes's book last week. We had Clark's book 3 weeks ago. The amount of information that is being thrown around at this time in an election season is unprecedented. The advertising, the back and forth, the leftist ads against Bush, Bush's own ads against Kerry. We are in an unprecedented political situation, not only because we're doing something unprecedented in Iraq, because we have an unprecedented military political dynamic with the war on terror and the war in Iraq.
John Podhoretz, let me ask you about this president and this evening. A lot of his associates have been in public saying a lot in recent days before hearings at the Pentagon in Baghdad. What is the message, or the symbolism for that matter, that President Bush can deliver, can transmit, that his associates cannot?
Well, it is President Bush's responsibility to frame the purpose of the conduct of the fighting in Iraq, of the battle that we are in, that was his great strength in the days before the war, that was his great strength in the days right after the war, and that he has lost some capacity to do, because he wants to make sure that, rather than sound triumphalist, that he is, you know, mindful of the fact that this is a difficult struggle and that this is a hard road ahead. But this war is based in an idea not only about the need to preempt the possibility of threats against the United States, but also an idea about the need to bring democratic change to the Arab and Islamic world for the purposes of finally and conclusively doing something about the war on terror that is not simply prophylactic, that can change the nature of the struggle against us.
And politically,
and he is the only person. It is he, only he, can make that case to the American people. His surrogates can't. His aides can't. His associates can't. This is his war. This is his battle. And he is the one who has to say, we're in this for the long haul. This is a long struggle. He was very good about that, if you remember, in the days after 9/11. You know, he said it's going to take decades to win this. You can't expect, you know, an unprecedented struggle like the one in Iraq to have, you know, some people did, obviously, but to sort of end with hearts and flowers and then sort of to come to an end and everybody happy and smiling. You know, this is a damaged society that lived under, you know, under a tormentor. There are unstable borders. There is a power vacuum and a power struggle going on. And this is a hard thing we're doing, not easy. And he's the one who has to make it clear why we're doing it and why why the struggle is worth the cost.
And we expect to hear that in the blunt language of President George W. Bush tonight. John Podhoretz, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
John Podhoretz, columnist for the New York Post. We are talking tonight about President Bush in the minutes leading up to his press conference coming up shortly. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In just about 8 minutes now, the president will step to a podium in the East Room of the White House and face the White House press corps for a primetime news conference, an event that he has not hosted on too many occasions. This will be only his 12th, only the 12th of his presidency, a very low number by any standards of any recent presidency. But there's a lot going on in the world, and apparently the president feels a need to put his stamp on it tonight. We're looking at the challenges President Bush faces this evening and the issues he is likely to be confronted with when he steps before reporters in just a few minutes. We're joined now from Washington by E.J. Dionne. He's syndicated columnist for The Washington Post and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. E.J., thanks for being with us tonight.
Good to be with you.
Frame the challenge for President Bush tonight as he looks out on this room full of journalists and a world with plenty of trouble.
Well, I think John Podhoretz had a nice phrase. I think he talked about the unprecedented cascade of news, and it has not been good news for the president. Think of just today. You had the FBI's acting director right before 9/11 criticizing John Ashcroft, the attorney general, for not taking terrorism seriously enough. You had Louis Freeh saying, well, we didn't have the money that it needed. You had the attorney general himself saying laws blinded our government to the threat. I mean, these are all called alibis. It's a problem when an administration is offering alibis at this point. Similarly, on Iraq, the administration chose to sell the war by downplaying the cost, saying we'd be greeted as liberators, and I guess you can only say whoops to that. The administration, I think, thought they could push hard things down the road, and tonight is kind of the end of that road. They delayed the 9/11 commission investigation.
Yes.
They held back documents. They couldn't sell the war. They didn't sell the Iraq war as something hard. And so tonight the president's kind of paying back a promissory note for all that.
And why George Bush? Do you think that he'll be able to put a better face on that, a different face on this, that has come out of the Pentagon or the State Department or his national security advisor? Does his blunt speech, which clearly appeals to a large portion of the American voting public, help in a moment like this?
Well, I think on Iraq, he does have to give people the sense that he and we as a country know what we're doing. He has to give people a sense that he has a practical road forward and that this isn't becoming a hopeless morass. And I think there he really does need to show some real command of the facts and convey more than rhetoric. He really has to persuade people that he's got some kind of strategy. On 9/11, I honestly did not understand the administration's approach to this. Congressman Chris Shays, good Republican from Connecticut, went on Larry King Live last month, and he basically said, look, we all failed. The executive branch failed. The legislative branch failed because when a country is attacked as we were on 9/11, it is a failure on the part of the government. I don't understand why President Bush can't say now, look, there were things I wish I had done. There were failures, and we've tried to fix them since. Instead, he keeps saying things such as in that famous presidential briefing that he got on August 6th, well, it didn't say there was going to be an attack. Well, the word attack is used over and over again in that PDB. I think he needs a different tone on that because I don't think this tone works for him at all.
E.J., Jack Beatty was sharing with us some of the poll numbers for President Bush, which recently have not been good. Newsweek's in particular showing John Kerry ahead by 7 points in a kind of a mock or poll heat there for the presidency. What do you make of the president's poll numbers at this point in his presidency in a reelection year? How bad, how good, how surmountable?
Well, this year is so strange that I'd be reluctant to say anything is insurmountable. But it's not very good given how much money he's spent. He's spent at least $40 or $50 million on these ads. I think he was making some progress in denting John Kerry's standing. And then along came these new revelations, the 9/11 hearings, the Clark book, and it just seemed to stop the whole Bush campaign in its tracks. And there was a recent study from a lot of polling done by the Annenberg Center at the University of Pennsylvania that showed that at the end of it all, so far, all this advertising has had very little effect. I think it's not good after having done all of that work to knock down John Kerry to have polls such as the Newsweek poll showing the president down by 7 points still.
Jack Beatty, what do you anticipate, what do you make of the president's persona, his leadership style, in a moment like this? He has had some very successful speeches in bad moments in his presidency. What about this moment and the president's approach to leadership?
Well, you know, he seems to me to take a kind of Mount Rushmore model of the presidency. You know, he doesn't really seek to educate. Franklin Roosevelt said that was the president's first and overriding duty, to tell the people, to prepare the people. Roosevelt used to even get maps out. Get out your maps. Look at the maps. This president doesn't persuade people of things. In fact, he said a very revealing quote. He said to Bob Edwards about his cabinet. He says, look, I don't have to explain anything. I'm the president. And he's had really terrible performances lately, and not according to me, but according to his conservative supporters on Meet the Press and other places, where he's just not seemed in touch with reality. So if he's going to try to persuade us tonight, for example, and try to answer the question, to whom are we going to hand over political power in another few weeks, that's going to be something new for him. And I rather suspect we're going to get more of the Rushmore effect, which is, I'm resolute, I'm strong, I believe what I believe, and there it is.
The president will be stepping to the podium in just a couple of minutes now to address a news conference that we will carry right here in full. And very shortly, we should hear the beginning of that conference. Dion, in brief, Jack Beatty says, quotes FDR, saying the president's job is to teach or help the public learn. We heard earlier from Ken Melman in this hour, they've got some big lessons they're trying to convey, that this is, the United States is in a war against terrorism, a war, in President Bush's words, against evil. There is a big line of teaching that they're eager to put out.
But see, I don't think the big theme tonight works. We all agree that Saddam Hussein was a bad guy and all that. That's not the issue right now. The issue is, if I may paraphrase the former governor of Massachusetts, the issue is competence. Do they have a plan to move us forward and to get us out of this mess? So I think tonight the large themes won't work. I think he needs to be very specific and persuade people that the things he wants to do next in Iraq actually make sense and actually have a chance of working.
Does President Bush have a different mode? Does this administration have a different mode, EJ, from the kind of high-in-the-saddle mode that's been the posture certainly since 9/11?
Well, right now, something went wrong at the beginning of this year. I agree with Jack, who mentioned the various performances, you know, Meet the Press, the State of the Union message. He did find a certain amount of rhetorical power after 9/11. Some of those speeches were very good speeches. Something since then has gotten disconnected, and maybe it's because when he was dealing with a large national tragedy, that lent itself to a certain rhetorical style that some of his speechwriters are very good at. This moment doesn't lend itself to that style, and it seems as if they haven't adjusted very well.
Jack, how do you read the flexibility here? There are no mean political thinkers in the Bush White House, Karl Rove among others, and they've got the most important stretch of their presidency, in a sense, right in front of them. Do you see adaptability here?
Yes, I think that they've shown that they can do that. This is the best politician in the country. There's no question about that. I mean, look where he is. But the task is hard when a president is up against realities that he just can't blink, that are just there in the headlines, in people's consciousness all the time. That's tough, you know, and when he says things as he did the other day, things are improving in Iraq, boy, that is just not going to do it.
Meanwhile, EJ, President Bush has the spotlight tonight. John Kerry seldom gets this kind of spotlight.
Well, I think John Kerry was perfectly glad to have Bush in the spotlight over the last 2 weeks. I think that when an incumbent is on the ballot, especially in a challenging time, the election is primarily about the incumbent. V.O. Key, the great political scientist, said elections are in large part retrospective referenda. I think Kerry's job is to make himself an acceptable alternative and not to allow the Bush campaign to knock him down or to make mistakes whereby he knocks himself down. The election is primarily about Bush, and in some sense, if Kerry can get out of the way and not make mistakes, that's actually a good week for Kerry.
E.J. Dionne, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Very good to be with you. Thank you.
E.J. Dionne, syndicated columnist for The Washington Post and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Jack, the president is about to step to the podium now. The press assembled in its fullness in the East Room. This is not an everyday event or anything like it. He's now approaching the podium. You can hear the cameras cranking up in the background. President George W. Bush about to begin the 12th full press conference and third primetime press conference of his presidency. The President of the United States.
Good evening. And before I take your questions, let me speak with the American people about the situation in Iraq. This has been tough weeks in that country. Coalition forces have encountered serious violence in some areas of Iraq. Our military commanders report that this violence is being instigated by three groups: some remnants of Saddam Hussein's regime, along with Islamic militants, have attacked coalition forces in the city of Fallujah. Terrorists from other countries have infiltrated Iraq to incite and organize attacks. In the south of Iraq, coalition forces face riots and attacks that are being incited by a radical cleric named al-Sadr. He has assembled some of his supporters into an illegal militia and publicly supported the terrorist groups Hamas and Hezbollah. Al-Sadr's methods of violence and intimidation are widely repudiated by other Iraqi Shia. He's been indicted by Iraqi authorities for the murder of a prominent Shia cleric. Although these instigations of violence come from different factions, they share common goals. They want to run us out of Iraq and destroy the democratic hopes of the Iraqi people. The violence we have seen is a power grab by these extreme and ruthless elements. It's not a civil war. It's not a popular uprising. Most of Iraq is relatively stable. Most Iraqis, by far, reject violence and oppose dictatorship. In forums where Iraqis have met to discuss their political future, and in all the proceedings of the Iraqi Governing Council, Iraqis have expressed clear commitments. They want strong protections for individual rights. They want their independence. And they want their freedom. America's commitment to freedom in Iraq is consistent with our ideals and required by our interests. Iraq will either be a peaceful democratic country or it will again be a source of violence, a haven for terror, and a threat to America and to the world. By helping to secure a free Iraq, Americans serving in that country are protecting their fellow citizens. Our nation is grateful to them all and to their families that face hardship and long separation. This weekend at a Fort Hood hospital, I presented a Purple Heart to some of our wounded. I had the honor of thanking them on behalf of all Americans. Other men and women have paid an even greater cost. Our nation honors the memory of those who have been killed. And we pray that their families will find God's comfort in the midst of their grief. As I've said to those who have lost loved ones, we will finish the work of the fallen. America's armed forces are performing brilliantly, with all the skill and honor we expect of them. We're constantly reviewing their needs. Troop strength now and in the future is determined by the situation on the ground. If additional forces are needed, I will send them. If additional resources are needed, we will provide them. The people of our country are united behind our men and women in uniform. And this government will do all that is necessary to assure the success of their historic mission. One central commitment of that mission is the transfer of a sovereignty back to the Iraqi people. We have set a deadline of June 30th. It is important that we meet that deadline. As a proud and independent people, Iraqis do not support an indefinite occupation. And neither does America. We're not an imperial power, as nations such as Japan and Germany can attest. We're a liberating power, as nations in Europe and Asia can attest as well. America's objective in Iraq is limited, and it is firm. We seek an independent, free, and secure Iraq. Were the coalition to step back from the June 30th pledge, many Iraqis would question our intentions and feel their hopes betrayed. And those in Iraq who trade in hatred and conspiracy theories would find a larger audience and gain a stronger hand. We will not step back from our pledge. On June 30th, Iraqi sovereignty will be placed in Iraqi hands. Sovereignty involves more than a date and a ceremony. It requires Iraqis to assume responsibility for their own future. Iraqi authorities are now confronting the security challenge of the last several weeks. In Fallujah, coalition forces have suspended offensive operations, allowing members of the Iraqi Governing Council and local leaders to work on the restoration of central authority in that city. These leaders are communicating with the insurgents to ensure an orderly turnover of that city to Iraqi forces so that the resumption of military action does not become necessary. They're also insisting that those who killed and mutilated four American contract workers be handed over for trial and punishment. In addition, members of the Governing Council are seeking to resolve the situation in the South. Al-Sadr must answer the charges against him and disband his illegal militia. Our coalition is standing with responsible Iraqi leaders as they establish growing authority in their country. The transition to sovereignty requires that we demonstrate confidence in Iraqis, and we have that confidence. Many Iraqi leaders are showing great personal courage, and their example will bring out the same quality in others. The transition to sovereignty also requires an atmosphere of security, and our coalition is working to provide that security. We will continue taking the greatest care to prevent harm to innocent civilians, yet we will not permit the spread of chaos and violence. I have directed our military commanders to make every preparation to use decisive force, if necessary, to maintain order and to protect our troops. The nation of Iraq is moving towards self-rule, and Iraqis and Americans will see evidence in the months to come. On June 30th, when the flag of Free Iraq is raised, Iraqi officials will assume full responsibility for the ministries of government. On that day, the transitional administrative law, including a Bill of Rights that is unprecedented in the Arab world, will take full effect. The United States and all the nations of our coalition will independent Iraq and how they can help achieve this goal. As we've made clear all along, our commitment to the success and security of Iraq will not end on June 30th. On July 1st and beyond, our reconstruction assistance will continue, and our military commitment will continue. Having helped Iraqis establish a new government, coalition military forces will help Iraqis to protect their government from external aggression and internal subversion. The success of free government in Iraq is vital for many reasons. A free Iraq is vital because 25 million Iraqis have as much right to live in freedom as we do. A free Iraq will stand as an example to reformers across the Middle East. A free Iraq will show that America is on the side of Muslims who wish to live in peace, as we've already shown in Kuwait and Kosovo, Bosnia and Afghanistan. A free Iraq will confirm to a watching world that America's word, once given, can be relied upon, even in the toughest times. Above all, the defeat of violence and terror in Iraq is vital to the defeat of violence and terror elsewhere, and vital, therefore, to the safety of the American people. Now is the time, and Iraq is the place, in which the enemies of the civilized world are testing the will of the civilized world. We must not waver. The violence we are seeing in Iraq is familiar. The terrorist who takes hostages or plants a roadside bomb near Baghdad is serving the same ideology of murder that kills innocent people on trains in Madrid and murders children on buses in Jerusalem and blows up a nightclub in Bali and cuts the throat of a young reporter for being a Jew. We've seen the same ideology of murder in the killing of 241 Marines in Beirut, the first attack on the World Trade Center, in the destruction of two embassies in Africa, in the attack on the USS Cole, and in the merciless horror inflicted upon thousands of innocent men and women and children on September the 11th, 2001. None of these acts is the work of a religion. All are the work of a fanatical political ideology. The servants of this ideology seek tyranny in the Middle East and beyond. They seek to oppress and persecute women. They seek the death of Jews and Christians and every Muslim who desires peace over theocratic terror. They seek to intimidate America into panic and retreat and to set free nations against each other. And they seek weapons of mass destruction to blackmail and murder on a massive scale. Over the last several decades, we've seen that any concession or retreat on our part will only embolden this enemy and invite more bloodshed. And the enemy has seen over the last 31 months that we will no longer live in denial or seek to appease them. For the first time, the civilized world has provided a concerted response to the ideology of terror, a series of powerful, effective blows. The terrorists have lost the shelter of the Taliban and the training camps in Afghanistan. They've lost safe havens in Pakistan. They lost an ally in Baghdad, and Libya has turned its back on terror. They've lost many leaders in an unrelenting international manhunt. And perhaps most frightening to these men and their movement, the terrorists are seeing the advance of freedom and reform in the greater Middle East. A desperate enemy is also a dangerous enemy. And our work may become more difficult before it is finished. No one can predict all the hazards that lie ahead or the costs they will bring. Yet in this conflict, there is no safe alternative to resolute action. The consequences of failure in Iraq would be unthinkable. Every friend of America in Iraq would be betrayed to prison and murder as a new tyranny arose. Every enemy of America in the world would celebrate, proclaiming our weakness and decadence, and using that victory to recruit a new generation of killers. We will succeed in Iraq. We're carrying out a decision that has already been made and will not change. Iraq will be a free, independent country, and America and the Middle East will be safer because of it. Our coalition has the means and the will to prevail. We serve the cause of liberty, and that is always and everywhere a cause worth serving. Now I'd be glad to take your questions. I will start with you.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, April is turning into the deadliest month in Iraq since the fall of Baghdad, and some people are comparing Iraq to Vietnam and talking about a quagmire. Polls show that support for your policy is declining and that fewer than half Americans now support it. What does that say to you, and how do you answer the Vietnam comparison?
Yeah. I think the analogy is false. I also happen to think that analogy is sends the wrong message to our troops and sends the wrong message to the enemy. Look, this is hard work. It's hard to advance freedom in a country that has been strangled by tyranny. And yet we must stay the course because the end result is in our nation's interest. A secure and free Iraq is an historic opportunity to change the world and make America more secure. A free Iraq in the midst of the Middle East will have incredible change. It's hard. Freedom is not easy to achieve, and we had a little trouble in our own country achieving freedom. And we've been there a year, Terry. I know it seems like a long time. It seems like a long time to the loved ones whose troops have been overseas. But when you think about where the country has come from, it's a relatively short period of time. And we're making progress. There's no question it's been a tough series of weeks for the American people. It's been really tough for the families. I understand that. It's been tough on this administration. But we're doing the right thing. You know, and as to whether or not I make decisions based upon polls, I don't. I just don't make decisions that way. I fully understand the consequences of what we're doing. We're changing the world, and the world will be better off, and America will be more secure as a result of the actions we're taking.
Thank you, Mr. President. What's your best prediction on how long U.S. troops will have to be in Iraq? And it sounds like you will have to add some troops. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, first of all, that's up to General Abizaid, and he's clearly indicating that he may want more troops. It's coming up to the chain of command, and if that's what he wants, that's what he gets. Generally, we've had about 115,000 troops in Iraq. There's 135,000 now as a result of the changeover from one division to the next. If he wants to keep troops there to help, I'm more than willing to say yes, General Abizaid. I talk to General Abizaid quite frequently. I'm constantly asking him, does he have what he needs, whether it be in troop strength or in equipment? He and General Sanchez talk all the time, and if he makes the recommendation, he'll get it. In terms of how long we'll be there, as long as necessary, and not one day more. The Iraqi people need us there to help with security. They need us there to fight off these violent few who are doing everything they can to resist the advance of freedom. And I mentioned who they are. And as I mentioned in my opening remarks, our commanders on the ground have got the authorities necessary to deal with violence and will in firm fashion. And that's what by far the vast majority of the Iraqis want. They want security so they can advance toward a free society. Once we transfer our sovereignty, we'll enter into a security agreement with the government to which we pass sovereignty, the entity to which we pass sovereignty. And we'll need to be there for a while. We'll also need to continue training the Iraqi troops. I was disappointed in the performance of some of the troops. Some of the units performed brilliantly. Some of them didn't. And we need to find out why. If they're lacking equipment, we'll get them equipment. If there needs to be more intense training, we'll get more intense training. But eventually, Iraq security is going to be handled by the Iraqi people themselves. Let's see here. Terry.
Mr. President, before the war, you and members of your administration made several claims about Iraq, that U.S. troops would be greeted as liberators with sweets and flowers, that Iraqi oil revenue would pay for most of the reconstruction, and that Iraq not only had weapons of mass destruction, but as Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld said, we know where they are. How do you explain to Americans how you got that so wrong, and how do you answer your opponents who say that you took this nation to war on the basis of what have turned out to be a series of false premises?
Well, let me step back and review my thinking prior to going into Iraq. First, the lesson of September the 11th is when this nation sees a threat, a gathering threat, we got to deal with it. We can no longer hope that oceans protect us from harm. Every threat we must take seriously. Saddam Hussein was a threat. He was a threat because he had used weapons of mass destruction on his own people. He was a threat because he coddled terrorists. He's a threat because he funded suiciders. He was a threat to the region. He was a threat to the United States. That's the assessment that I made from the intelligence, the assessment that Congress made from the intelligence. That's the exact same assessment that the United Nations Security Council made with the intelligence. I went to the UN, as you might recall, and said, either you take care of him or we will. Anytime an American president says, if you don't, we will, we better be prepared to. And I was prepared to. I thought it was important for the United Nations Security Council that when it says something, it means something for the sake of security in the world. See, the war on terror had changed the calculations. We needed to work with people. People needed to come together to work, and therefore empty words would embolden the actions of those who are willing to kill indiscriminately. The United Nations passed a Security Council resolution unanimously that said, disarm or face serious consequences. And he refused to disarm. I thought it was very interesting that Charlie Dulford, who just came back, he's the head of the Iraqi Survey Group, reported some interesting findings from his recent tour there. And one of the things was he was amazed at how deceptive the Iraqis had been toward UNMOVIC and UNSCOM. Deceptive in hiding things. We knew they were hiding things. A country that hides something is a country that is afraid of getting caught, and that was part of our calculation. Charlie confirmed that. He also confirmed that Saddam had the ability to produce biological and chemical weapons. In other words, he was a danger. He had long-range missiles that were undeclared to the United Nations. He was a danger. And so we dealt with him. And what else part of the question? Oil revenues. Well, the oil revenues are they're bigger than we thought they would be at this point in time. I mean, 1 year after the liberation of Iraq, the revenues of the oil stream is pretty darn significant. One of the things I was concerned about prior to going into Iraq was that the oil fields would be destroyed. But they weren't. They're now up and running, and that money is it will benefit the Iraqi people. It's their oil. And they'll use it to reconstruct the country. Finally, the attitude of the Iraqis toward the American people, it's an interesting question. They're really pleased we got rid of Saddam Hussein. And you can understand why. This guy's a torturer, a killer, a maimer. There's mass graves. I mean, he was a horrible individual that really shocked the country in many ways, shocked it into a fear of making decisions toward liberty. That's what we've seen recently. Some citizens are fearful of stepping up. And they were happy they're there. They're not happy they're occupied. I wouldn't be happy if I were occupied either. They do want us there to help with security. And that's why this transfer of sovereignty is an important signal to send. And it's why it's also important for them to hear we will stand with them until they become a free country. Elizabeth. Excuse me.
To move to the 9/11 Commission, you yourself have acknowledged in the